This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with journalist Norman Solomon, who has just returned from Afghanistan.
If you think this war in Afghanistan is winnable, listen to Norman Solomon. If you think this war is about stopping terrorism or stopping Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, hear what Norman will tell you what the New York Times doesn't.
We'll also talk with Dar Jamil about his book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. His book is a compiled report of dissent within the U.S. military. Stay with us.
We're happy to have Dalia Hashad back in our studio, the fourth and wonderful member of our team of Law and Disorder. Dalia, welcome back to Law and Disorder. Well, we love having you back.
Thank you. The fourth and occasional member, unfortunately, but it's great to be back.
We agree. We love having you here. So Dalia has been traveling a bit and now is back with us.
What's your take on the eighth anniversary of the two hijacked planes slamming into the World Trade Center just down the block from our recording studio? I was in bed in my apartment a block away. You were jogging past the buildings when it happened. It was really a horrific day, personally for us and historically. Looking back after 8 years, what's your take?
You know, I mean, we saw 9/11 used as a pretext, excuse, whatever you want to call it, for two really main areas we can talk about. There's probably more, and we only have a few minutes this morning to do this. But one is the area of fundamental freedom, civil liberties, and a whole set of intrusions on those going from warrantless surveillance to preventive detention to others we can mention. And then a second aspect was just putting this country again, resuscitating to the extent that was ever moribund, war footing and war. And we saw both come out of 9/11. And sadly to say, even under this new administration, most of those, what we called building blocks of a police state, are still with us. And certainly the war is with us very, very heavily.
You could say in a nutshell that the 9/11 attacks handed the extreme right in this country their program on a silver platter.
Well, it certainly did. In fact, I remember writing early on the program that Reagan came in with in 81, which was articulated in a book called Mandate for Change by the Heritage Foundation, was finally put into full effect after 9/11. As I said, we're not going to spend a lot of time looking at each thing because we've done that before. But if we look at just on the civil liberties issues or constitutional issues, we saw the Patriot Act with its nastiness around what's considered terrorism, electronic surveillance, looking at our records. And that, despite having a so-called sunset provision, which meant it was supposed to expire 3 or 4 years after 9/11 or five, was, of course, renewed and extended. So that Patriot Act is still with us. We had the presidential military order saying the president had the authority to pick up any non-citizen, eventually extended to citizens, and hold him in an offshore or hold him in a penal colony, wherever, offshore or inshore. Sadly, that's not been repealed, and we see the Obama administration currently looking at schemes of preventive detention. Then we had extensive warrantless wiretapping in the United States carried out unlawfully by the Bush administration. We then see now that the current administration is continuing that, although now under a congressional statute that, sadly to say, President Obama voted for. And then, of course, we have state secrecy as a way of avoiding and preventing the exposure of the torture program that was run by the Bush administration, as well as other nefarious acts they were engaged in. And despite Obama twice already in public speeches promising to roll back the assertion of state secrets in courts, that has not occurred. And finally, of course, as we've talked about many times, we're seeing no real efforts at prosecution right now. So that's the civil liberties in a nutshell, Michael, if you'd like to expand on it a bit, and then we'll go to the war.
I heard Obama speak 2 weeks ago to the Veteran for Foreign Wars, and it was like he was channeling Bush in his rationale for the American war in Afghanistan, using the same rationale, fear. Fear, of course, is very useful as a weapon.
Dalia, you know, first, where were you on 9/11, and what's your reaction after 8 years? Were you more hopeful that things would change under Obama?
No, I was not more hopeful that things would change under Obama. I think I've been disappointingly unsurprised. This is pretty much what I expected from Obama and unfortunately, things seem to be continuing as they were before. And we've talked a lot over the past years about what's happened to Muslims in America after 9/11. We saw the detentions. We talked about the sending of people abroad, using immigration law to detain people when the criminal law wouldn't allow it. We've talked about FBI harassment. Those things all continue today. One update that we should mention from this summer highlights how things really haven't changed and in some respects have become worse because they're no longer front page news. People think they're a thing of the past, that Obama has changed all the practices, the awful practices of the Bush administration. And just this summer, not many people know, but 7 men in North Carolina, 6 U.S. citizens and 1 permanent resident, were arrested on charges of providing material support for terrorism and conspiracy to murder, kidnap, maim, and injure people abroad. And that sounds pretty awful. But when you look at what they actually did, is some of them are accused to have traveled to the Middle East, specifically Israel and Gaza. If you want to go to Gaza, you have to go to Israel. And Jerusalem and Jordan. The central figure held prayer meetings in his home. They owned weapons. You know, they live in rural North Carolina. They hunt and fish. And that's it. There's a vague conspiracy charge. There's travel, and there's weapons.
These people were indicted this summer, Dahlia?
Yeah, they were.
And they're in what state again?
They're in North Carolina in this really rural town. And the central figure in the case is a man named Daniel Boyd. He's 39 years old. His 2 sons, who are 22 and 20, Zachariah and Dylan, were arrested as well. And law enforcement, speaking anonymously, have said that there's no evidence that there's been any communication to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban.
Now, I recall the story now. It was the front page pictures in the Times of Boyd, who was a Muslim convert.
Yeah, a white American.
Right, and others, and it was sort of neighbors' complaints and not liking the lifestyle or something. I don't remember what it was.
The FBI says they've been monitoring these folks for 3 years, but in 3 years they have nothing.
But it's Boyd case if people want to look it up. More.
Well, I mean, what's really interesting is go on the white supremacist websites and see the comments that people have left about these crazy Muslim white people. How could they have converted to Islam and the craziness that people say about Muslims. But the really interesting thing to me is the backstory. Sabrina Boyd is Daniel Boyd's wife. She's a 41-year-old American-born convert. She's had 5 kids with him. One of her children died 2 years ago. He was 16 years old. He died 2 years ago in a car accident. On the day her husband and children were arrested, unbeknownst to her, someone showed up at her door. And it was who she thought was a family friend. And his shirt was bloodied. And he said, "Your husband and your kids have been in a really serious car accident. You need to come to Duke Hospital." So she got in a state trooper car that was waiting for her. And she went to the hospital. And they took her not to the front of the hospital or to the emergency room, but to the back where there was a construction site. And a man who was dressed as a doctor and came out and said he was a doctor came out and he asked to shake her hand, and she said, "You know, I don't shake men's hands for religious reasons." And he took her hands and he handcuffed them. And he said, I'm a federal agent. I'm not a doctor." And he asked her if she had any weapons of mass destruction on her.
Where might she be hiding them?
Well, you know, what's really funny is as soon as I read that, I started laughing because my husband, we were coming back from a civil rights conference in New Orleans, and we were going through security, and I was telling someone in front of us, "Oh yeah, my husband always gets stopped. It's pretty routine." And I looked behind me to see where he was, and sure enough, TSA was patting him down. But instead of looking annoyed, my husband Hisham was laughing this time. And I asked him after he was through, "What are you laughing about?" He said, "The guy asked me if I had any weapons of mass destruction on me."
I can't believe it.
I flew home from Minnesota last week, from northern Minnesota, Bemidji Airport. I got there. We were outnumbered by security people 7-3. And, you know, they busted me, and they test for explosives on the wild rice that I was bringing back.
The Boyd story, sadly, I mean, here we are 8 years after, it seems to just be very similar to other stories we've had throughout the country of these arrests of, you know, people who are Muslims for very, very shaky evidence.
Well, I mean, if they've been monitoring them, they should have, if these people are truly engaged in criminal activity, there should be something criminal in here. But everything that we've seen publicly, none of this is criminal. Everything that we know about. And what's interesting is when the story came out about what they did to the wife and it was actually the daughter, wife and daughter and the pregnant daughter-in-law. When the story came out about that, the U.S. District Attorney said, I'm sticking to the four corners of the indictment. We try our cases in court. Now, that's a blatant lie because they try their cases in the press first. They put out information about individuals that is either false or misleading. They brand them terrorists, and then we come to find out years later that there's no case. We've seen this again and again. It's a pattern that started on 9/11 and has continued to this day with Muslims in America, rounding people up on the streets, saying that we are, you know, Ashcroft holding the press conferences, saying that we are catching terrorists and pulling them out of the mosques and putting them in detention facilities when really they are people who overstayed their immigration visas, and sometimes not even that. To the questionings by FBI, the mass roundups and questionings of FBI of Muslims. And these people are innocent, have done nothing wrong, and yet they have FBI agents showing up at their homes, at their workplaces, questioning them as if they were criminals.
Adai, I remember that was when I met you. That was when your early job shortly after 9/11 was really counseling people who were visited by the FBI. And I remember when I met you, you were counseling a prominent middle, upper middle class doctor in New Jersey, if I recall,
that
who had been
right,
visited.
Yeah. Who had, interestingly enough, cooperated with the FBI early on. And this is a good lesson. Unfortunately, the Muslim community learned it late. But for years, we would go around saying, the FBI, these people are not your friends. Do not meet with the FBI without an attorney. Don't go voluntarily and extending your hand to the FBI because they are there going after you. They're not there to help you. You know, it's really an unfortunate state of being, but that's what it is. And until recently, Muslim communities were meeting with FBI agents pretty regularly until they got burned so many times with undercover agents, COINTELPRO type operations, that in March of this past year, a large Muslim coalition said very publicly, we are breaking from continued cooperation with the FBI because the FBI is not respecting our civil rights and civil liberties and not respecting the Constitution. Listeners can go back and listen to two interviews that we had with Shakil Saeed, lawanddisorder.org, and you can hear firsthand about some of the really horrifying experiences that the Muslim community has had.
Well, Dalia, there was one just recently that I'd like you to update our listeners on with the six Muslim clerics that were kicked off the airplane for praying.
That's a good one. That's actually a victory. We're still
seeing.
We do
have victories. Victory on material witness warrants. We will be talking about another one, the Al-Kid case, which took apart Ashcroft's material witness warrant stuff. But why don't you tell us about the six Muslims kicked off an airplane? All this really post 9/11, obviously.
Well, you know, it's funny. 8 years after 9/11, we are still so hungry for good news. We are still thirsting for victories. And so we really savor them when we get them. But we had some good news, great news, this summer. People may remember that six imams who are Muslim religious leaders were on their way to a conference or on their way home, and they were kicked off a flight after they prayed, said Allah, and spoke in Arabic. And this was pretty recently. So they filed a lawsuit. After they filed their lawsuit, Congress passed a shield law giving immunity to those who report suspicious terrorist activity in good faith. And this was done in large part in response to the lawsuit that the imams filed. Recently, a Minnesota federal judge ruled that the immunity granted by Congress does not apply to law enforcement. Now, what the judge said was, when a law enforcement officer exercises the power of the sovereign over its citizens, she or he has a responsibility to operate within the bounds of the Constitution and cannot raise the specter of 9/11 as an absolute exception to that responsibility. No reasonable officer could have believed that they could arrest the plaintiffs without probable cause. Love that.
That's completely amazing because it will reflect what happened in the Al-Kid case in a way about probable cause.
There aren't many moments like this, but that made me proud to be American. That was wonderful.
If they could only apply the probable cause requirement across the board, right?
I know.
That's great.
What a novel idea.
So now this suit is going to be able to proceed to damages.
It can, yes, absolutely. Hopefully a sign of good things to come with or without Obama's participation and help.
Dahlia, a few days ago you sent me a short news article about a defendant in a criminal trial who had had duct tape put across his mouth. And of course I was amazed because it reminded me of the trial of the Chicago 8, then 7, after they duct taped Bobby Seale and strapped him to a chair as one of the most iconic images of racism in the United States ever.
Well, he was the head of the Black Panther Party.
Right. Ever.
That's right.
And to see that a judge did this again, what happened?
Well, that's exactly what I thought of when I saw this. In Ohio, a 51-year-old man is on trial for robbery, and he's unhappy with his defense attorney, same thing as Bobby Seale. He interrupted several times to make his case, and the judge was unhappy with this, so he used duct tape to seal the defendant's mouth shut. Just truly amazing, unbelievable that it would happen in the United States, but again, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
It is amazing. I mean, when you send me the story, I mean, that's something that, as I said, it happened 40 years ago at Chicago.
But I can't believe this. We have judges like this sitting on the bench. But
considered one of the most embarrassing incidents in America 40 years ago. And today, apparently, other than three lines in a news story, we had no notice of it.
This judge doesn't know his or her history.
Michael, there have been some interesting developments in Spain.
We cover on this show a lot the possibility of prosecutions for the torture conspiracy. And we all know what Eric Holder has done recently, which is go after the people who did torture plus, which is to say they went above the guidelines of the allowable torture and went above, and he initiated a criminal investigation, which we think, as we said, is more or less a sellout and not going after what's really going on. I think one thing the U.S. hoped for possibly is that the Spanish, once Eric Holder did this, might drop the investigation of the torture conspiracy in Spain, which is now before two judges, one of them Balthazar Garzon, who is the judge who did the Pinochet case. But that did not happen. And in fact, yesterday there was a news article saying that Eric Holder's appointment of a prosecutor would not be sufficient to derail the Spanish inquiry into the cases. That doesn't mean it's over because there's other things going on, but that's at least one very positive thing, that investigation in Spain of the torture conspirators is continuing. At the same time, the Spanish government, which is different than the Spanish prosecutor or different than Balthazar Garzon, the investigating judge, is putting huge pressure on Garzon, and apparently there's a criminal inquiry into Garzon's opening an investigation into the crimes of the Franco regime and opening up, trying to get orders to open up the cemeteries and dig up the bodies. And the right wing in France is going after Garzon on that issue. So they're putting pressure on him on that.
What's the basis for the criminal investigation, Michael?
In October of 2008, Garzon opened an investigation into the atrocities committed during the Francisco Franco regime, 4 decades of that. And he asked for all of the papers of that regime to be turned over to him so he could begin criminal inquiry in that. And now the right wing has filed a criminal complaint against him that he exceeded the official powers of his office in doing that. And apparently the judge will have to appear in court to defend himself against that claim.
A criminal complaint?
That's a criminal complaint. So that's what's going on in Spain, because Garzon is the one, you have to understand, is reaching out to try and nail, really, in many ways, the Bush people. The other thing that's going on in Spain is there's a change going on to the universal jurisdiction law, the law under which you can go after international criminals. It will restrict it a bit. It won't affect the Garzon cases against the U.S. officials, because those are based on the fact that Spanish citizens and residents were tortured at Guantanamo and in other places, which gives Spain a special handle. It would affect the case, for example, brought against an Israeli general for bombing Gaza, unless there is a plaintiff or somebody in Spain who has a relationship to Spain suing that Israeli general. But that they're also trying to narrow the universal jurisdiction, really apparently at the behest of the Israelis and the Chinese.
That's awful.
So a lot going on in Spain. Again, we won't know until October or November how well the Spanish prosecutions are going to proceed and whether Garzon will have enough room to do it. There's huge pressure on him, obviously, from the United States as well as from Spain. Zapatero, despite his claim to be liberal and a socialist, is very close to the United States and trying to repair some of the damage with the U.S. that's happened during the Bush administration. So we don't know how the pressure is going to play out on Judge Garzon.
And do you know what kind of pressure the Obama administration is exerting?
You know, we don't know. We know there's been meetings with the with embassy officials and Spanish authorities, and we assume the Obama administration is saying, even saying things like, well, you see Holder's doing something now, and this would really be bad for our relationships. And, of course, they have all kinds of levers, economic, political, military, a million different levers the United States has over every country in the world. Over the last few weeks, we've been reading a lot about Afghanistan. Should the U.S. send more troops? Should they send a lot more troops? What's this war about? Why are we there? To give us a perspective on the war in Afghanistan, today we are joined by Norman Solomon, Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Solomon is the author of War Made Easy: How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. He's written several articles about his experience in Afghanistan and has recently returned from a visit to Kabul. His articles have detailed the war-torn landscapes, the stunning civilian casualties, and the desperate living conditions of Afghani children. Norman, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Norman, there's a lot of public debate about what's going on in Afghanistan and what the U.S. needs to do in the future. You recently returned from Kabul. Tell us a little bit about your impressions.
Well, it's actually worse than the mainline media in the U.S. would tell us. The sources are so circumscribed through most of the mass media. And I also discovered, as the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, which sponsored our trip, as we reached out to members of Congress, that frankly, people in the U.S. House and Senate who do go to Afghanistan travel in a bubble, and they're taken around by the Pentagon and the embassy through the U.S. State Department, and they learn very little. Often they don't speak to any Afghans who aren't part of the Karzai government. What I saw was the reflection of the real priorities, not the rhetorical emphasis of the Obama administration and the Pentagon, and that is to wage war. And humanitarian aid and assistance to people in Afghanistan is basically an afterthought. You know, it's in the foreground for the PR, but it's really in the background when it comes to actual policy.
Norman, tell us a little bit about your impressions of what the Obama administration and the U.S. media feed the public about Afghanistan and how reality actually differs.
Well, you know, I would say that the emphasis on the war as something that is to help the people of Afghanistan is very much central to what the pitch has been now for 8 years. While a lot of Afghans actually welcomed the U.S. Invasion for toppling the Taliban, what we're now seeing is a real turning away from enthusiasm from Afghan people towards the presence of U.S. troops, and particularly the escalation. I mean, it's really hard to gauge what Afghan opinion is because, in part, we have so much territory of the country that's hard to get to or dangerous for Americans and so forth. And the Americans that are there under arms, and that's a whole different picture. But I would say, basically, Afghans are outraged at the U.S. killing of civilians and outraged at the air war.
How widespread is the killing of civilians?
Well, you know, that too is hard to gauge, but even the press reports are going through a familiar cycle of first denial from officials and then acknowledgement, whether it's the recent bombing of a couple of fuel tankers or whatever, that civilians were killed. And it just goes to the fact that intel is the intelligence on the ground that gets to the Pentagon is often extremely faulty. They see Afghanistan from far away, from grenade length, or from actually some capacity to go ahead and do surveillance from 1,000 feet in the air or whatever. So I think that really a lot of the suffering is way beyond the numbers of people killed. You know, the UN will say, well, 2,500 or 3,000 civilians are killed in a one-year period, 40% of that ascribed to the U.S. and allied actions. But that's just part of the picture. One of the big killers is poverty. If you look at all the statistics, you see Afghanistan virtually at the bottom around the world of infant mortality, of maternal death. And just to give you one statistic, out of 1,000 live births, there are 165 deaths of infants in Afghanistan before the first birthday. And so when you have a death rate of 16% in the first year of life, that is an indicator of just how desperate the country is for genuine humanitarian aid. But I think here's a very telling statistic that has its consequences on the ground in terms of killing so many people. The Progressive Caucus of the U.S. Congress held a series of forums in the spring of this year and came up with a recommendation that was presented to the White House for 80% non-military U.S. spending in Afghanistan, only 20% military. Obama came back with a supplemental package, 90% military. That's a huge gap, and you can see the human consequences on the ground.
Well, that's extraordinary. Norman, you know, I've been reading a lot about the so-called debate, they call it, in the administration about whether to escalate 20,000 troops or 40,000 troops, or even another part of the debate, whether we should use drones, and all of it in the context of what is it going to take to stop Al-Qaeda from reemerging and Afghanistan becoming a terrorist haven. Is that really what the issue is, or is something else going on in terms of this, the goals of the war that we're not talking about in the, in our mainstream media?
Well, it's notable that there's virtually no Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and that's been true for quite a while. So, you know, it is just a huge hole in the argument coming from the administration and the war supporters in the media. Yeah, let's send more U.S. troops to a country where there is no Al-Qaeda presence in order to stop Al-Qaeda. Of course, Al-Qaeda is in Pakistan and in perhaps dozens of other countries, and when we hear that the U.S. must remain and escalate its war in Afghanistan so that that country cannot serve as a base where Al-Qaeda or other such groups could then launch an attack on the United States, those criteria are met by dozens of countries. So does that mean that we will, in the words of John Stockwell, the former CIA agent, be in search of enemies around the planet and therefore want to wage war in dozens of countries? This is a prescription for endless war. You know, the agendas, I think, are much less defensive and much less high-blown. They have to do with geopolitical positioning, also the capacity of the U.S. to later be able to affect the flow of oil and natural gas from Turkmenistan and elsewhere. In the 1980s, there were enormous maneuvers by UNICAL and an Argentinian corporation to be able to secure rights to build a pipeline from the Central Asian area down to a warm water port in Pakistan or whatever. And I think that gets us closer to where the agendas are long term.
And that's why we have 62,000 troops there, 6,000 more before 09?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's multifactorial, but certainly the whole geopolitical positioning and the long term economic agenda of the U.S. is really primary. And whatever impetus there was initially to go in there after 9/11 and to topple the Taliban, that has long since gone by the boards.
You know, Norman, some days I want to take the Times and just rip it into little pieces, because the entire debate is just what we've been talking about. Yeah, the entire debate in the Times is only about what we need to stop Al-Qaeda. There's not a word about why we need another troop there for any other reason. And that's the way they phrase the debate. I find it it's just so disturbing, and to hear you talk about it so clearly makes it very obvious.
Well, there's so much hostility by absence and by blowing smoke from the mass media, certainly including the New York Times, to actual history. You know, it's not just the Taliban. There's another very ideologically driven extremist leader, Hekmatyar, who was a favorite of the Saudis, of the U.S., of the CIA, the Pakistani ISI, where throughout the 80s and 90s and onward, enormous resources funneled to him. He's now aligned with the Taliban and fighting. We hear about how the Haqqani network is so terrible, and it is in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, that also being a favorite of the U.S. ally, Pakistan, and the United States. In fact, the entire hateful, misogynist Wahhabi ideology was funneled into Afghanistan beginning in the 1980s on the backs of the U.S. and the Saudis, and with the Stinger missiles and the billions of dollars of military assistance was this ideology, which is foreign to Afghanistan. We and the Saudis and the ISI of Pakistan brought this ideology to Afghanistan, subverted, in the words of one Afghan I talked to, destroyed Afghan culture, and now we're using that, we, in the sense of the U.S. government, using that as a pretext to expand our military actions and the killing in Afghanistan.
Norman, I have one last question as we close up this short segment, but important one on Afghanistan, and that's the elections. And of course, you know, the Times, again, on the first day after the elections, had this incredibly positive article about the elections in Afghanistan being so good and so many people coming out to vote. Of course, if you read to the end, you saw that a lot of people didn't. And of course, now there's massive allegations of fraud that are even believed by at least many Western officials, including probably those in the United States. What do you think is going to be the outcome as you sit here? What's going to happen?
Yeah, the wheels are coming off the PR caravan here.
Norman, you're
precisely right.
This demonstration election has crashed and burned. And
nice word, demonstration, you know, election.
The reality is, you know, that if we read something like the Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid's book, Descent into Chaos, he documents how soon after 9/11, the CIA almost literally put its collective institutional hands on the shoulders of Hamid Karzai and said, "You're our boy." And so he was elected at a conference dominated by the U.S. in Bonn, Germany, to be the leader of Afghanistan. And until recently, Washington was pretty happy with the guy, but he's so clearly inept and corrupt, and now illegitimate given the massive vote stealing that he is and ballot stuffing he has done. And so in the recent months, really, there's been a big tilt and a lot of favorable coverage in the New York Times and elsewhere towards Abdullah as the alternative. Well, he's hated by many people in Kabul and elsewhere because he comes from the Tajik warlord Massoud's stable of warlords and killers, and Abdullah was central to the carnage in Kabul between 1992 and 1996, when two factions of warlords were shelling and rocketing each other and the civilians in Kabul, killing an estimated 65,000 people in those 4 years. And so now he's sort of been whitewashed as Malala Joya, a dissident feminist activist Afghan in Kabul, told me a couple weeks ago, you know, they have cleaned him up, given him a shave and a fancy suit, and now Abdullah is being put forward by the U.S. media and the establishment in Washington as some sort of credible democratic alternative. Bottom line is, this was a battle between two configurations of warlords with blood on their hands, and democracy and human rights are the clear losers.
Norman, we can't let you go without getting your very quick impression on the Gates report that said Gates has no sense of how long this war will last, no sense of how many troops they will send over before they feel they've actually won, in quotes. He actually said that it's a mystery as to how long U.S. forces will be in Afghanistan. What are your impressions?
Yeah, this would be what Rumsfeld called the unknown unknowns. I would say overall, from a historic standpoint, from the standpoint of human well-being, Gates just and his policy just has no sense, period, because this is the open-ended, endless war repetition compulsion that has dated from the times of the Vietnam War. And usually the U.S. is able to dominate a country quickly, such as Panama, and the underpinnings and the propaganda groundwork for the war doesn't have time to unravel before the U.S. vanquishes its adversaries. But in this case, as in the case of Vietnam, as in the case of the Iraq War, it can't be ended so quickly or so easily by the Pentagon. This war could go on for many, many years. The carnage will increase. It is a humanitarian disaster that continues to unfold. And the solution really, I think, has to do with humanitarian aid and military activity being inverted in terms of proportion, so that we should have almost all of the U.S. involvement be absolutely humanitarian, and in the process, there would be a way of engaging diplomatically in the region. Because as long as the ISI service of the Pakistani government continues to fuel various Islamic extremists inside Afghanistan, including the Taliban, then the U.S. can send in troops and bomb all at once. But the killing will simply continue inside Afghanistan.
And that looks like the direction we're continuing to head in. We've been there since October 2001. 10 years is right around the corner. The Gates report said that all military officials inside and civilian officials inside and outside of Afghanistan talked about 2 years, 5 years, and 10 years. That's 20 years that we'd be talking about being in Afghanistan.
So yeah, I would just add that the horizon, yes, keeps moving, and the solution is for more and more members of Congress to get the backbone to stop appropriating money for this military action in Afghanistan, and that will only happen when we build from the grassroots movements and pressure to compel them to do that.
Why do you think Obama has just gone for the whole thing hook, line, and sinker? Did we have better expectations? Were we misled? What do you think it is?
Well, you know, I was saying a year ago, the best way not to be disillusioned is not to have illusions in the first place, and I said that as an Obama delegate. I think that he has really become more and more enthralled with and captive of the military-industrial complex. He buys into the assumptions, just as Lyndon Johnson didn't want to be known as somebody who, quote-unquote, lost Vietnam to communism. Obama doesn't want to be known as a president who lost, quote-unquote, Afghanistan to terrorists. And once that logic or illogic is fulfilled, then it is getting on the train to more and more war and seeing no other route. And that's where Obama's stuck. It's the conventional wisdom. It's the new generation and version of the best and the brightest. And as usual, it's only grassroots action that will turn that around.
Norman, you've written a number of articles about Afghanistan. Can you tell our listeners where they can go, what website to read some of your work on Afghanistan as well as other work?
Sure. I've posted all of them at my website, which is normansolomon.com.
Norman, thank you for a really good interview, informative, and keep up the great work.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Norman.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The majority of the people in the United States has opposed the continued occupation of Iraq and the continued escalation of the war in Afghanistan. There is growing public distrust surrounding those wars. The question is whether there is growing resistance among the ranks of U.S. soldiers to those wars. The mainstream media have failed to report anything about the increasing number of soldiers taking a public stand against the war and those that are finding ingenious ways to express their defiance. Today we interview author Dar Jamal, who has compiled a report of dissent within the military. His recent book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, documents the growing resistance, despite the fact that there is no draft to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Dar Jamal, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
Dar, Haymarket just published a book you've done called The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's really quite amazing, given the lack of an anti-war movement in this country, that these soldiers are doing this with quite a great exposure to themselves.
And the lack of a draft. So these people are people who, I mean, quote, voluntarily were in the military.
Exactly. But tell us, let's talk about Afghanistan first. Tell us what the situation is over there and what you've uncovered in your book.
Well, we're looking at, of course, a massive escalation that everyone's aware of. We have just over 60,000 U.S. troops there at the moment, and by the end of the year, there will be 68,000. Less than 2 weeks ago, Anthony Cordesman, the senior advisor to General McChrystal, the U.S. general in charge of all U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, Cordesman advised McChrystal that after the surge is done, I'm advising you to add an additional 45,000 U.S. troops there. And this is against the backdrop, of course, of last month being the single deadliest month for U.S. and NATO forces of the entire occupation. And right now, this month, we're on track to possibly set yet another grim record. So it's against that backdrop, with things really spiraling out of control in Afghanistan and more troops being sent there and of course, coming back home in body bags and wheelchairs a lot of the time, we're seeing a corresponding uptick in the amount of resistance within the military because, you know, these stories of the lack of Veterans Administration care and people having untreated PTSD and TBI and things like this, this is not lost on people in the military. I mean, word goes around quick in the grapevine there, and more soldiers are hearing about this. And interestingly, especially very recently, more and more soldiers are getting that, similar to Iraq, the occupation of Afghanistan is also in violation of both international and domestic law.
Okay, you raised a lot of important subjects here. We're talking to Dar Jamal, who is the author of the book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. Let's start on Afghanistan. What does the book talk about in there? Are these people you interviewed when they were back? Are there people you saw in Afghanistan? Are there people who were on the front lines? Are there people who were in VA hospitals? Why are they resisting and who are they?
Well, it's a book about soldiers who served in both Iraq and Afghanistan. The book is actually more focused about what was happening regarding Iraq, but then I had to start cramming in a lot of last-minute updates right before it went to press because all of a sudden there's this burgeoning amount of resistance in the military against going to Afghanistan. And so it basically focuses on both active-duty troops and veterans. And I spoke with people on the outskirts of bases. I spoke with people at different conferences that I ran into and then did a lot of in-person as well as telephone interviews with people who were resisting for all kinds of reasons and in all kinds of ways. There's a very interesting chapter. The lead chapter is about resistance on the ground in Iraq, for example, where we're seeing a repetition of things that were happening during Vietnam as far as, like, search and avoid missions, for example, when soldiers are very disgruntled. They don't like driving around waiting to be blown up, doing what they call the IED lottery, the improvised explosive device lottery, like, is this going to be the day? And so morale was so low, the genesis of the book was I talked with a man named Phil Aliff, a corporal in the U.S. Army who was in Iraq, and said, look, we were all completely disgruntled. We didn't want to die. We wanted to get home. We didn't like these bogus orders, and we didn't like the fact that there was no end in sight to the occupation. So we started going and finding big open fields and parking our Humvees and just pretending and calling into base every hour and saying, yep, we're still searching the field for weapons caches. And he said they were doing that every other day. And then I ran into more and more soldiers hearing very, very similar stories, but at different parts of Iraq and at different times of the occupation. So all kinds of different resistance, both in Iraq as well as when folks come back home.
Now tell us, Michael Smith asked you a bit about Afghanistan, because this book goes back in time a bit in Iraq, and of course now there's even more focus on Afghanistan. But can you give us a little bit on what currently is happening in Iraq? Is there still this kind of resistance in Iraq? Does it take any more overt form than simply parking the trucks out in the field? Are there people who've actually been disciplined for it?
Most of it in Iraq is covert, and it has gone from a bit more overt resistance to more covert there, and it is ongoing. I've actually had contact with troops over there in just the last few months who are still engaged in doing search and avoid missions, but oftentimes, and I mentioned this in the book too, how this really plays out, rather than a big public stand of like a whole unit standing down and refusing to follow an order, as has happened a couple of times, which I also address. But more often than not, we see a very, very demoralized unit being sent into what they know is going to be an extremely bad situation just because the military has to keep running a certain amount of patrols. And when it comes time to suit up and gear up and go get in the Humvees and head out of their forward operating base, literally everyone's just sitting there, and then the commander walks in and sees it, and rather than causing a big commotion and possibly risking media exposure, he just walks out and then comes back in and says, all right, the mission's canceled, and we'll let you know when we're going to do something else. So that's actually not uncommon as well. And more recently, I have been following stories literally in just the last couple of weeks of soldiers who've done tours in Iraq, come back home, and then are set to be redeployed either by stop-loss orders or just because they still have some time left on their contract, but this time to go to Afghanistan. And literally just within the last 3 weeks, we saw in a two-week period two soldiers from Fort Hood, Texas, in central Texas, the biggest Army base in the country, in as many weeks, both publicly refused orders to deploy to Afghanistan, one because it was against his moral reasons and he had applied for conscientious objector status, and the other because he was citing the UN Charter and the U.S. Constitution.
Let's stay for a second on Iraq and then take you to Afghanistan. You gave Michael Smith some update on Afghanistan. Where would you say the U.S. is now in Iraq? Are they pulling soldiers out? Are they putting them in? Are people still refusing to go to Iraq?
For the moment, the U.S. is basically in a bit of a holding pattern in Iraq. We still have about 131,000 U.S. troops there, which is still a higher number than before the so-called surge of George W. Bush. And so we have, though most of these soldiers have pulled out of the cities and are basically sitting tight on inside the massive bases, and this is why we're seeing a pretty dramatic decline in the number of U.S. troops being killed there. This is going to possibly be one of the lowest months of the entire occupation, which is good, but the bad news is that we're really not seeing many troops pulled out of Iraq to come back home, and what few companies and sometimes brigades have been pulled out, most of those have actually then been given a little bit of a break and then sent right into the fire in Afghanistan. And so in Iraq, we are still seeing people that are publicly refusing orders here to go over there. There's still a lot of people in Canada trying to stay there. And even there's now an instance of a man named Andre Shepard over in Germany who also had served a tour in Iraq and then came out there for a break and went AWOL and went underground for a while and is actually seeking a political asylum in Germany because he says he doesn't want to go into Iraq and be a party to war crimes.
We're speaking with Dar Jamal, who's written The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. Dar, I was active during Vietnam as an attorney defending soldiers who resisted. As distinguished from now, these guys were draftees, and there was a massive anti-war movement in the country, and there was a lot of sentiment that actually thought that the United States had no business being in Vietnam, and there were even people in the United States Army that supported the Vietnamese. It was kind of a mutual search and avoid because the American soldiers would want to avoid the Vietnamese, and the Vietnamese said, these soldiers are not our enemies, it's the American government that's our enemies, not these boys, and they would avoid the Americans, so they kind of have a consent to walk past each other and not engage. But in any case, in Afghanistan and Iraq, there's no mass movement here, and there's no draft. So these guys enlist probably because of the poverty draft, you know?
Yeah.
And then they're stuck over there, and then they realize that it's a dangerous job and a really demoralizing job because they're probably not even sure, you know, why they're there. But what was your assessment of, in terms of the level of political understanding that these guys that resist have?
Well, it's really across the board. I mean, when folks ask me why are people resisting, I mean, on one end of the spectrum we have sloth, and then on the other end of the spectrum we have people like Lieutenant Watada, who at the time back in fall of 2000 or summer 2006 was the highest ranking member in the military to publicly refuse a combat deployment to Iraq, and of course he was citing things like the UN Charter and the U.S. Constitution and the oath he swore to protect and defend the Constitution by only following lawful orders as prescribed in the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So very high-minded moral and ethical ideals. And then, of course, everything in between. But what we are seeing is that, you know, there is a big problem now, and I think that one of the big hindrances of there being a growing GI resistance movement that would start to at least look a little bit more like what we had during Vietnam is a lack of political consciousness among soldiers and also a lack of awareness. The military does a really good job of not informing soldiers of their rights, people are led to believe that once they join the military and sign the dotted line, that's it. You've basically just signed your life away. Your job now is to do nothing but follow all orders regardless, which, of course, goes right up against the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which says, a soldier is duty-bound not to follow unlawful order. But the military doesn't inform people about this. They largely don't inform people that they still can apply for conscientious objector status. So there is a big problem here, and as compared to Vietnam, when we had dozens and dozens of GI resistance cafes on the edges of bases where folks could go in and learn more about their rights and what they could do to resist, as well as over 100 underground GI resistance newspapers that were published by soldiers themselves for the most part. Now we have just a small beginning of that. There are 3 GI resistance cafes, and there's a couple of more in the works. They're very, very effective in giving soldiers a place to come in and educate themselves. They have libraries and computers and GI rights folks that come in there and lawyers sometimes that hang out and can talk to them about what are their rights and what can they do if they want to try to refuse a deployment. But overall, that is actually a big problem, is that there's really a lack of political consciousness. And I think that a lot of that is due to the fact, as you mentioned, that there really isn't a very broad, vibrant anti-war movement that can try to help change that.
It shows you how infinitely clever and flexible the system is. We thought we won a victory when we got rid of the draft. And instead, they offer a lot of money to get people over there. And they also go out and they just hire soldiers of fortune, not just in the United States, but hire a company like, say, Blackwater, or then recruit people from the army in Colombia and send them over to Afghanistan. So instead of having a civilian army that's part of the fabric of the United States, you have a mercenary army, which makes it much harder for us to exert any kind of pressure on the situation.
That's right. It's really a situation where for this thing to really coalesce, a real GI resistance movement is going to be dependent upon a corresponding broad, vibrant anti-war movement, and those things I think will go hand in hand. And I think that makes it really all the more remarkable when we see, for example, soldiers like what I've been writing about in just the last few weeks, 2 guys from Fort Hood, Specialist Victor Augusto, and then followed by a court-martial the next week of a Sergeant Travis Bishop, 2 guys that basically took it upon themselves to educate themselves. This started happening actually while they were both deployed over in Baghdad, and as well as in northern Iraq, and reading books and learning about their rights, and then coming back home and figuring out a way to find lawyers and try to go up against the system. And I think it's really, really remarkable that given that there's not a draft, that we do have an all-volunteer force, with a volunteer in parentheses or in quotes, because we definitely have a poverty draft happening, but kind of against all odds, we still see people that are managing to politically educate themselves, figure out what their rights are, and then go about resisting in a very smart way.
Dar, when we came across your book, again, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's almost as if it's the only time I've ever read anything about that, that there doesn't seem to be any media coverage of what's happening in the military and the will to resist. I mean, have there been attempts to try and get media coverage? Is it just a refusal? What's going on?
Well, you're right. I mean, there's been almost no media coverage whatsoever, and I fully expect that to change as more and more resistance is created by this so-called surge, and then probably the one that's likely to follow after that of troops into Afghanistan. But, there's been a few instances here and there, particularly regarding Iraq, of, this unit refused to go do a fuel delivery because they had broken down vehicles and not enough armor, and so they literally didn't do it. There was another instance a bit after that, I believe it was in 2007 in Baghdad, when Charlie Company in the Army decided, look, we're not going to go out on this patrol, and the whole platoon stood down in order and said, nope, we're not going to do it. Of course, we have the corporate media and the obvious reasons why they tend not to report on people's movements and soldiers resisting and these kinds of things like this. But at the same time, the military has done quite a good job thus far of trying to keep this under very, very tight wraps, because given that there's not a draft and given that they know it would be total political suicide to institute a draft, they need to keep a very, very tight lid on all these soldiers or any of these platoons that are refusing orders, because if this starts to spread and this starts to get out in an all-volunteer military, they are looking at really, really big problems. What would they do to find these people? And right now, We're looking at a military that's extremely stretched thin. Where are they going to get more of these troops to send back into both these occupations? We're looking at the leading generals in Iraq saying there'll be definitely in excess of 100,000 troops there, at least halfway through 2010. And of course, we already talked about the massive escalation of Afghanistan. So the military is basically doing a good job of keeping it under wraps, keeping these guys quiet. Sometimes they'll throw the book at someone when they think they can get away with it and give them a very lengthy time in jail as a result of a court-martial. But oftentimes we'll see them back down and basically just give soldiers what they ask, try to get them out of the system and shut them up.
Yeah, well, what they really don't like is the spotlight of public opinion on their operation. Dar, your final thoughts on what listeners can do to help these soldiers who resist. Are there any websites to connect to, any organizations you want to mention? What can people do to help these people, Dar?
There's a lot people can do to help soldiers who are resisting or who are considering resisting. They can go to Iraq Veterans Against the War website, which is IVAW.org, who are actively trying to work in this field. There's CourageToResist.org, the group I mentioned earlier. There's the GI Rights Hotline. There's the Military Law Task Force. We mentioned Aaron Watada earlier, and he really, when he gave a speech during the time of his speaking up and publicly refusing orders to deploy to Iraq, he really lined out what could well be a blueprint for a GI resistance movement, and that is communities coming together around these people in their area and letting them know that they will be supported if they stand up, their families will be supported if they have to go do jail time and are away from their families, and that they will have their back, because economics right now is probably the leading reason why we don't have more people standing up and being willing to go do a serious amount of time in jail and lose a lot of their pay. And I think there's a lot that communities could do to alleviate that.
Dar Jamal, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. One more time, listeners, Haymarket Press has given us an excellent book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Dar.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.